The following lecture is under copyright by Reformation Christian Ministries and is for your personal use only. It is not to be copied or otherwise distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. Contact information will be provided at the end of this lecture.
As we finish our discussion of a philosophical background to church history, or really a philosophy of history, there's one more thing that we need to point out, and that is, as we look at the sweep of history, including the modern age, there is a very fundamental lesson to be learned, and that is that orthodoxy builds the church, and heterodoxy, that is, false teaching, destroys the church. This has been something that has happened again and again over the history of the church, whether we're looking back to some of the early heretics like Marcion and the Donatists, or whether we're looking into the present day as we look at the charismatic movement, or as we look at some of the cults that have grown up in the United States, we find that false teaching in the name of Christianity destroys the church. And of course, we realize that people like the Mormons or the Jehovah's Witnesses think that they are the true Christians. And yet we see that again and again, what they do by their teaching is destroy real Christianity. And so that's something that we need to learn, because one of the things that we need to be very careful about is to maintain an orthodox biblical Christian church. Because if we don't, we are not going to be used by God to develop the church and to build it for the future. So that's a very fundamental thing that we learn from church history. As we look now at the beginning of the 17th century, we're going to begin at about 1600 in our course, we need to realize that there are some things that are happening in the world around the church, which are important for the life of the church. Some of those things are that the Protestant gains in Europe were at their height. The Lutheran and the Reformed controlled a great deal of Europe, of Germany. They had not yet controlled the Netherlands completely, but that was quite well on the way. And the areas in France, in southern France, there were some areas that were controlled by Reformed people. Down in the south part of France, around Rochelle. And then we realize, of course, that Switzerland was reformed, and that the Lutherans had pretty much taken over the Scandinavian countries, Norway and Sweden and Denmark. And so this was the height of the gains of Protestant Christianity in Europe, because Europe is about to sink into what is called the 30 Years' War, which began in about 1618 and ended in 1648 with the Treaty of Westphalia. The Peace of Westphalia ended the 30 Years' War, and that was in 1648. And during that war, the Roman Catholics attempted, with a great deal of success, actually, when all is said and done, to gain back a lot of the losses that they had sustained through the Reformation. They had not sustained these losses militarily. They were losses that had come to the Roman Catholic Church by way of the teaching of Protestantism and the conversion of large areas of Europe to Protestant teaching. Yet the Roman Catholics gained a great deal of this back and destroyed a great deal of the Protestant lands through military conquest. And that's something that needs to be understood about the 17th century. This was a century in which Roman Catholicism struck back militarily. And while they were not completely successful in destroying Protestant Christianity in Europe, not by a long shot, yet at the same time they were successful in gaining back a great deal of territory. And the Peace of Westphalia deeded to them large areas of Europe that had previously been Protestant at the end of the 16th century. So the 17th century is going to see a lot of changes. And there are also changes in England. And we're going to actually start with England and some of the history of England when we get into the actual history of the modern church. But first of all, we need to look at also some changes in the world with respect to the 17th century, from the medieval era to the later era of history. Of course, the medieval era of history had started to come to an end with the Protestant Reformation. And in fact, there were a number of things, developments in the scientific world, the idea that people need to study the sources, for example, as in humanism, were very fundamental to the Reformation. Humanism introduced studies into the scriptures, for example, into the Greek and Hebrew scriptures, so that people were actually able to find out what the Bible said. And then, of course, the idea of translating it into the people of language of the people comes out of the medieval humanism at the end of the medieval age. And in fact, these are the things which brought real intellectual life down to the people. What intellectual life survived during the medieval period survived in the monasteries and a few other places in the Roman Catholic medieval church, but there was very little that got down to the local people and even to the local priests. It is said that many of the local priests could not say the Lord's Prayer or the Apostles' Creed in the language of the people by the time of the Reformation, that things had sunk so badly that intellectual knowledge was almost nil of the great achievements of the past. And, of course, the Roman Catholic priest could say the Mass in Latin because that was his job, but to actually know Christian doctrine in the language of the people was quite rare, and most priests never preached. They simply did the Mass, and that was their service for the people. Well, Reformation, because of that, was needed. But there are also some other things that are important in the changes from the Reformation to the later age that affect all areas of life. For example, at the end of the Reformation period, we have the rise of Arminianism, which is kind of a marriage of the Pelagianism of previous ages, of the pre-medieval age, with Reformed teaching to produce a kind of semi-Reformed or semi-Pelagian teaching, although usually the word semi-Pelagian, I should point out, is referred to the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church, where man cooperates in his works with God's work, and thus man is saved by a cooperative work between God and man. But what we mean by Arminianism being semi-Pelagian is that it allows man to have a great deal of say in his own salvation. Now, the Reformers, including the Anabaptists and the Lutherans, were what we would call today Calvinists. They believed in predestination. They believed in salvation completely by grace. They believed in depravity. Martin Luther's greatest work theologically was The Bondage of the Will. By the way, it was Martin Luther's own opinion that this was his greatest work. And it speaks, of course, of what we today would call the total inability of man to do anything to save himself. And so the original Reformers we would have thought of as Calvinists because they were all predestinationists. They all believed that God decided who was saved and who was not. And then out of later Reformation period came the idea that all men are depraved, but that God does a work of grace in the heart of every man, which enables him to choose salvation. And that's basically Arminianism, the idea that even though man is depraved by the fall, God sends Christ to die for everyone, and he does a work of grace. The Arminians, the Methodists called it prevenient grace, a work of grace in the heart of every human being, which enables him to believe the gospel. So the point is that that Arminianism is not Pelagianism. Now, I think, and it was pointed out to me, interestingly, by a man who was a minister in an Arminian church, that most so-called Arminianism today is actually Pelagianism. It actually believes that man has free will, that he is basically good in his heart, and that if he is not too influenced by sin, or if he is convinced to make up his mind, he can make up his mind to believe in Jesus Christ and be saved. And so he really doesn't even need prevenient grace. So that's a very fundamental difference that we have. But the Arminianism that grew at the end of the Reformation granted the idea of total depravity, but claimed that all men were not totally depraved anymore because in Christ there was this work of grace which would enable them to believe the gospel. We also have a change in government between the medieval times and the times following the Reformation. We have what might be called the rise of a more democratic process, principles by which government was to be established. The people of England, for example, began to realize that the Magna Carta, one of the founding papers, constitutions we would call it almost, although it wasn't really that. It was a declaration of the rights of the leaders of the various estates of England with respect to the king. And yet the idea began to flower that all people should have some kind of right to rule themselves, and that you don't have a paternal state which you had in the medieval system, but you could even have a two-party system. And that began to really arise in England in the beginning of the 17th century, in the early 1600s. In literature, you had some great developments. Of course, Shakespeare wrote about this time. You have Dryden and Congreve later in the century. So there was a tremendous increase in English literature in what we think even today as classic English literature appeared during the early part and the later part then also of the 17th century. But you had also the beginning of great scientific progress, the founding, for example, in 1660 of the Royal Scientific Society was very important to the progress of science, because the Royal Scientific Society of England became kind of a sounding board and a testing board for all kinds of scientific theories and ideas, in which people who had training or who had taught themselves to do certain kinds of science could talk to each other and could critique each other's ideas and inventions and so on. And it became a great center for the discussion of progress in science, and has a great deal to do with the development of a modern scientific establishment. You also have, during the 16th century, the tremendous upheaval in England, the 17th century, during the 1600s, during the middle of the century, starting in 1642, you have the Commonwealth, the overthrow of the monarchy in England and the taking over by Oliver Cromwell and the Republicans, who ruled the government for about 20 years. And there was no king in England, but there was a parliament. And England was ostensibly ruled by the parliament, although Cromwell himself eventually became more and more of a despot. And unfortunately, the experiment in republicanism didn't really work as well as it might have in the situation. But nevertheless, that was a tremendous upheaval in England. And it's interesting to note that to this day there is a republican movement in England. And if you ever visit the Parliament building, the House of Commons in England, the only statue in the moat, there used to be a moat, and now the moat is dry. It's got grass on the bottom of it. But the only statue outside of the Commons, the House of Commons in England, is that of Oliver Cromwell. And yet, among the people who guard the Queen and so on, there's a great deal of royalism. I remember my wife and I were visiting in the Tower of England, and we were down in the vault underneath one of the buildings where the crown jewels of England are kept, and it's really an amazing display of wealth. But in any case, we were there, and I noticed, I didn't make the connection in my mind because I was thinking about other things, but I asked why there were no crown jewels that dated earlier than 1660. And the beefeater, the guard, the royal guard, very angrily sniffed that they had been destroyed by the Republicans. And of course, then it hit me very clearly that that's exactly what had happened. And there's still an anger among the royalists against the Republicans for overthrowing the king and so on. And I suppose that's to be expected, but it's a rather interesting thing. The point being that there was a tremendous upheaval in England that has had great implications for how the monarchy works and what kind of government you have in England to this day. And so as we look at the 17th century, we're going to see a real transition from the somewhat less developed Reformation of the first 100 years of the Reformation to the more developed Christian situation, especially as we come to the end of the 17th century. And it's interesting that these are great days for Holland, the little Dutch country that had the greatest navy on the seas during this age. And the Dutch call the 17th century the Golden Age, the Golden Century, because of the tremendous wealth that flowed into Holland through its merchant marine and through the fact that the Dutch navy was one of the greatest navies on the oceans of the world. And so there's a lot of things that happened during the 17th century that are of interest and useful, had useful influences on the whole matter of Christianity. So now as we look at the ending period of the Reformation, we need to recognize that the Reformation was really coming to a close, in the sense that no more groups were leaving the Roman Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church at the Council of Trent, which ended in about 1565 or 63, had pretty well established its teachings as opposed to Protestant teaching, and there's very little unrest in the Roman Catholic Church following that time, even though there was there are some small groups who do still leave the Catholic Church after that. But the Reformation is basically over from the point of view of the great sweep of Protestant doctrine across Europe and the removal of thousands of people from Roman Catholic control into Protestant churches. Well, let's now go to England. And beginning at the beginning of the 17th century, we see that James VI becomes James I of England. And that was a very important point in history as far as England is concerned, because it was really the union of the two nations, England and Scotland. They had always been separate nations, and in fact, even during the Roman occupation of the British Isles, much earlier, Hadrian's Wall, which goes across the north end of England, south of Scotland, was the limits of the Roman Empire. The Scottish people were never subjugated by the Roman Empire, and they hated the idea of being subjugated by the British. In fact, there is still some resentment back and forth about that. But the point is that here, James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England. And of course, I think most of you who are taking this course are aware that the various monarchs of Europe intermarried. Many of the families are related to each other of the various monarchs around Europe. For example, when Queen Elizabeth II, who is presently Queen of England in 1997, when I'm giving this lecture, when she married Prince Philip of Greece, she was marrying a fairly distant relative of hers. And the British ruling family has more German blood in it than any other kind. And so those are the kinds of things we're dealing with here. So when James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England, you have a union of the two nations under one king, even though there continued to be two parliaments. And there were some differences in how the history of the two nations developed. For example, the British never did adopt the Westminster Confession as a whole. The Parliament did adopt it, but it never became in any real respect the Confession of the Church of England. On the other hand, it was adopted by the Scottish Parliament in 1649 and has ever since ruled as the creed of the Scottish churches, even though, of course, liberalism has crept in, and the State Church of Scotland, the Church of Scotland, has had several groups leave to form more conservative Bible-believing and creedal groups. But nevertheless, that's a difference between England and Scotland. Well, as we come to the beginning of the 17th century, the Puritan movement is beginning to be underway. And it, of course, is a movement away from a high church in the Church of England. They wanted to purify the Church of England. That's really how the Puritans began. It was their purpose to be a biblical Calvinist. They had learned a great deal from the Calvinism of the Protestant churches on the continent, and they wanted to purify the Church of England. Now, this is something that bothered a great many of the bishops, the leaders of the Church of England, because they were really somewhat Protestant, but also still somewhat Roman Catholic, and especially hierarchical as far as their views of church government are concerned. They still believed in monarchical bishops, that is, a bishop who makes a decision on his own rather than in council with other leaders in the church. And I think we need to understand that that is the fundamental difference between hierarchical government and Presbyterian or Reformed church government. And that is that Presbyterian and Reformed church government says that all decisions are made in council, whether it is the council of elders in the local church approving the confessions of faith of people who are becoming communicant members, or whether it is the synod of the church deciding which creeds the church will have. Those are decisions always made in council. So one minister or one bishop, of course, in the Bible, the word minister, bishop, and elder are used fairly interchangeably. We need to be careful about that, because the word bishop is not really biblically in hierarchical office at all, but that these offices then always operate in council in a Presbyterian or Reformed church government. whereas a bishop, for example, or even a priest in a hierarchical church makes decisions on his own. He decides who is to be baptized. He decides whose confession of faith. If they make that kind of a thing, a lot of times they don't even have much of a confession of faith, but who is to be an adult member, a confessing member of the church, and so on, is done by one person, not by a council. Well, that's very important because James the sixth, when he became James the first of England, became the head of the Church of England. That's something that operated right through the time that Henry the eighth removed England from the authority of the papacy. Henry the eighth declared himself to be the head of the Church of England, and to this day, the monarch of England is considered to be the highest officer in the Church of England, which is rather interesting because, of course, the king is a civil government officer, not a church officer, and so you have the union of church and state. And so James I had a great deal of influence and interest because from the time of Henry VIII, he was considered to be the head of the Church of England. Well, a conference was held with the Puritans at Hampton Court. And at that conference at the beginning of James's reign in England, James already was negative to the Puritans because he realized that their view of church government would have implications for civil government, and that is that it was wrong to have an absolute monarch. Now, the only really positive thing that came out of the Hampton Court conference was that it resulted in the machinery for the King James Version of the Bible. James I, of course, was a typical late medieval monarch, and the church did not want people reading the Bible. That's how the Church of England was operating up till that time. And John Wycliffe was actually run down by the then what we would call the CIA, the Secret Service of the British King, and he was put to death in Belgium because he had smuggled his English translation of the Bible into England. What happened is that as James I was coming to London to take the throne, on the way, a number of Puritans, in fact, it was supposed to be signed by 1,000 Puritan ministers, or people, I should say, was the millenary petition, a petition asking for some changes in the Church of England, which would purify it of some of the high church practices and also of some of the nominalism, that is the idea that just being a member of the church is all you have to do to be saved in order to have a more purified church of true believers. Well, anyway, the Puritans presented this petition in 1603 as James was traveling to London to become king, and then in January of 1604, the Hampton Court Conference was held. Unfortunately, James was not, as I said, personally favorably disposed to Puritanism because of the ideas of government that they had, namely that the church ought not to be governed from above by bishops. They were basically, unfortunately, many of them congregationalists. They didn't really have a Presbyterian doctrine. They really had a congregational doctrine, which I would assess to be a reaction against hierarchicalism rather than a return to biblical government, in which there are real councils which have real authority. Congregationalism wants everyone to be pretty much his own boss with respect to Christianity. And, of course, that's a very popular idea today. Well, during the time of James I's reign, the Puritans were increasingly active in their teaching. They established lectureships in some of the churches in order to teach their ideas alongside of the ministry of the Anglican rectors and so on. And so there was some reaction to that. What happened is that under James's reign, William Laud became the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, the Canterbury See, or the Canterbury seat of the bishop, is the most important bishopric in the Anglican Church, and it is to this day. And I would recommend that anyone who's interested in traveling in England or studying church history on the spot spend a day at the cathedral in Canterbury. I remember I was there, I think the first time was in 1982, and it was when It was during the early part of Easter week, and we ran into the Archbishop in a beautiful red robe going to lead a Vesper service, and it was somewhat galling to read a week later in the newspaper here back in the United States that the Pope had visited Canterbury and had been embraced by the Archbishop of Canterbury. But in any case, William Laud was very much an anti-Puritan. He hated Calvinism. He very much wanted a high church liturgy, that is, a very Roman Catholic worship service in which the sacrament was at the center of the worship service rather than the preaching of the Word of God. And he was so high church that even some of the loyal Anglicans disliked him. But he did as much as he could to hold back Puritanism and Calvinism from the Church of England, and because he was the Bishop of Canterbury, he had a great deal of influence with respect to that. Now, there was also, on the other hand, a bishop by the name of Hales, who was the leader of the English group that went to the Synod of Dort later on in 1618 to 1619. He was an English commissioner at Dort, and interestingly, the English commissioners were the only ones of the people from all the nations, and there were people from Switzerland and Germany and other countries as well as Holland at the Synod of Dort, but the English delegation, and particularly Hales, was the only one who opposed the Calvinism of the canons of Dort, and that, I think, represents pretty well the position of the Church of England in that day. Now, James himself liked the mediating position between Calvinism and the High Church Anglicanism. It's rather interesting. He even had a book on the Sabbath published that took a mediating position between a Calvinist position of strict observance of the Sabbath and an Anglican position of not really keeping the Sabbath at all. It was called the Book of Sports, by the way, because it talked about the various kinds of things that might be done on the Sabbath by Anglicans. Now, eventually, William Laud, the Bishop of Canterbury, became very violent in his opposition to the Puritans who were called now nonconformists because they didn't conform to the rules of the Church of England. Many were forced to immigrate. This is when you had the emigration to Massachusetts from England. I think most of you will remember that the Puritans landed at Plymouth Rock and founded the Plymouth Colony in 1620. Now, what happened is that Laud, of course, because of his influence in the church, was able to keep the Puritans at bay pretty much. Nevertheless, one of the things that did happen is that the medieval informality and irreverence at worship slowly gave way to a more reverent worship as people realized that worship is not just another bit of entertainment to be attended during the week. This also was during the time when pews first began to be used in churches in England. Yeah, we can give the English credit for that. Before that, during medieval times in England and in Europe and in all of the Roman Catholic churches, people attended the Mass standing up. As a matter of fact, they would drift in and out and they would be gossiping, talking to each other until it was time for the miracle of changing the wine to the blood of Christ, as the Roman Catholics believe, and then one of the acolytes would ring a bell, and the priest would elevate the host, thus signifying that it had been changed into the body of Christ. Rather interesting change happened here. Now, the pews were first used by nobility. They had, by the end of this century, by the way, the pews had little box, I'm sorry, not the pews, but the nobility had little box areas where they were separated by or fenced off from the rest of the people in church, and they would actually have tables and would be sitting and eating during the worship service while the rest of the people stood. Well, this all was coming in, and Laud was a strict Anglican, and he opposed these things rather heartily, even though he was not able to stop them. Well, in 1625, remember, James I ascended the throne in 1603. He died in 1625, and he was followed by Charles I. Now, he was the son of James, and he pretty much followed his father in these things. One of the things that he tried to do that didn't work very well is he tried to operate on the same principles with respect to Scotland. He wanted a similar book of prayer in Scotland as in England. And there was a revolt against this in Scotland in 1637. After about 12 years of this, the people in Scotland just revolted against being Anglicized. They did not want to be Anglicans. They were Presbyterians, although that word was perhaps not in as full use then as it is later about them. But they were really Calvinist Protestants, much more in line with Puritan thinking. And so they reacted violently, finally in 1637, against the idea of reforming the Church of Scotland in the image of the Church of England. Now, what this did was it renewed the Covenanters. The Covenanters had shed their blood at the earlier time of the Reformation during the reign of Bloody Mary to maintain their covenants, not to participate in a government that was Roman Catholic and to participate in a church that was Roman Catholic. And the covenants were agreements, covenants among the people of the church, the leaders and the people, that they would not participate in that kind of thing. And so that covenanter interest was renewed and a covenant was signed all over in Scotland to push for the independence of the Scottish church from the state. And the, of course, the state didn't give in and the people of Scotland would not give in. And so the king, Charles I, began to prepare for war against Scotland, and actually hostilities broke out when the Scots invaded England. Now, what happened was that Charles, of course, wasn't as well prepared as he could have been, and one of the reasons was that he had to get money from Parliament. One of the things that the British kings could not do was raise taxes by themselves. They needed the Parliament to do that. And so the king, in his preparation for war after the Scots invaded England to defend themselves against the Anglicization of the Scottish Church, Charles called what later came to be called the Short Parliament to get tax money for war. Well, the British Parliament, the English Parliament, refused to give him money, and it was dissolved by the king. Then he called another Parliament, hoping that this would be better, more in his favor, but unfortunately for his position, the Puritan leaders became more and more popular in their opposition to the war that Charles I wanted to prosecute against Scotland. And so this one came to be called the Long Parliament, but it was worse for Charles I than even the Short Parliament was. Well, they not only refused to provide money for the war against the Scots, but most of the Puritan elders were contrary to the whole idea of episcopacy in the first place, and many of the members of the Long Parliament were Puritans. So finally, the people in Scotland sent copies of their covenants down to England, and many of the English Puritan leaders signed what now became known as the Solemn League and Covenant, and it was a covenant against the imposition of Anglicanism in the sense of a hierarchical high church Anglicanism upon the people of Scotland. And so in 1642, as a result of the rise now of a rebellion against the king led by Oliver Cromwell, who was a Puritan nobleman. He was not a clergyman. He was simply what we would call a landowner, a noble, in the sense that he ruled a certain part of England by owning the land. He turned out to be a very able person, but as a result of the uprising in England, Charles, in 1642, had to flee London. Well, that led then to the eventually to civil war. There were a number of ideas that now came forth, which I think are worthy of note. A man by the name of Rutherford wrote Lex Rex, which is the rule of law. And their basic ideas were a community can choose its own government. Government is not imposed upon people, but people have the right to choose their own government. Again, the idea that men are free and not bound. and that people may resist tyrants was a third idea. Well, of course, when this was published, Lex Rex was burned publicly, and Rutherford was charged with treason. And so those ideas, however, were beginning to be popular, even though Rutherford was put in jail for publishing them. A little bit later on, another Puritan by the name of George Gillespie wrote a pamphlet called Aaron's Rod Blooming, and that wrote against government interference in the church, the idea that the church ought to really be separate from government and that the government ought not to interfere in the life of the church. Well, these things went on until finally there was civil war. And as I said, Oliver Cromwell was the leader of the separatists or of the Republicans. He was a very good Calvinist Puritan. If you get a chance, there's a movie, and I think the movie is just, the name of the movie is Cromwell. I did find it once in a video catalog, but I think it's a fairly accurate movie about that period. I haven't watched it in recent years. I remember seeing it about 20 years ago, which is getting to be quite a long time ago for freshness of memory, but I remember it to be a very good movie. And I remember the opening scene in which Cromwell walks into the church in his village, and he finds that the king has put a gold cross and I think a gold chalice on the communion table. And Cromwell comes in and throws the cross on the floor because, of course, the Puritans were very much against any kind of an image, including crosses. And then he finds out that one of the men in the church has had his ears cut off for reading the Bible. And so he's very, very angry about that. And that, of course, eventually leads then to civil war, in which the king is driven up towards Scotland. And finally, he goes into Scotland and expecting, since he is also the king of Scotland, to be protected by the Scots. But they don't do that because he's been trying to impose Anglicanism upon them. And so finally, they deliver him back to the British, and he is put to death under the hand of Cromwell. But it's a very interesting story. Cromwell seems to have lived an ordinary life as a land owner until he is elected to Parliament, and then he begins to show a great deal of leadership. And when Parliament decides to rebel against the king in England, why, Cromwell was put in charge of the parliamentary army. He turned out to be an excellent military leader. His men followed him fearlessly. That's one of the great reasons for his success, is that he was a great military leader. He led them. He did not follow them. He showed himself to be a man of God in the sense that he led his troops in prayer. His troops sang psalms as they entered battle and that kind of thing. And in 1646, they defeated the king's army. As I said, the king surrendered then to the Scottish army. And so you have then a new situation in England, because you have a situation now which is called the Republic, in which there is no king. The king is now really in the custody of the Scottish army, and England is now ruled by Parliament completely, except, of course, that Oliver Cromwell in a few years is going to declare himself to be the Lord Protector of the English state because of some of the things that are going on that he feels are not responsible in the Parliament. Well, we come now to the Westminster Assembly. As soon as the king left England in 1642, he fled. It wasn't long that and Parliament began to take over the work of ruling the country. And the Parliament already in 1643 met, and it discussed already then the government of the church, and it called the Westminster Assembly basically to discuss the government of the church. And the Westminster Assembly met in the Jerusalem chamber of Westminster Abbey, which is still there. If you go to England, the time you want to visit Westminster Abbey is on a Wednesday evening, because during the rest of the week, the entrance to all the side chapels and all the extra rooms and places in the abbey cost you money. You have to pay an extra half a pound or so to get in. But on Wednesday nights, entrance to all of these things is free. So that's a little bit of tourist information from somebody who's been there. But the point is that the Westminster Assembly consisted of 10 members of the House of Lords, 20 members of the House of Commons, and 121 theologians. Now, by the time the Westminster Assembly met, the Solemn League and Covenant negotiations were already underway between the British Puritans and the Scottish people from Scotland. And, of course, that Solemn League and Covenant was eventually adopted, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But the Westminster Assembly, as I said, was called to consider the government of the church, and they actually produced a form of government for the British church, which was never adopted by the British Parliament, but was adopted by the Scottish Parliament eventually and became the basis for Presbyterian church government in the modern sense. The Presbyterians had already in Scotland developed the idea of the rule of the church by the minister and elders of the local congregation. And so the Westminster Assembly, as they discussed the government of the church and as they came to conclusions about that, just continued discussing matters of doctrine. And eventually out of that came the Westminster Confession. It's rather interesting that their first calling was to discuss not doctrine, but to discuss government. And so they adopted the Solemn League and Covenant. They approved that, which was then approved by the Parliament. And the Solemn League and Covenant, of course, was a Calvinistic doctrine. It pushed Reformed ideas. It required every citizen over the age of 18 to sign it. It was adopted by Parliament in 1643. Now, because of the requirement for signature, there were problems, because 2,400 clergymen and 800 others refused to sign the Solemn League and Covenant. In other words, they wanted to remain Anglican, and they fought against that with a great deal of vigor. It was imposed on the Church of England in February of 1644. The people who refused were removed from their posts, and about 30% of the parishes in England were affected by that. Some of the Puritans now began iconoclasm, that is, cleansing the churches of images and statues and so on. And so the assembly then ended up with a much broader work to do. And that, of course, now comes to the theological work of the assembly, and we will take that up in the next lecture.
This lecture is copyrighted by Reformation Christian Ministries, the parent organization of Reformation International Theological Seminary and Reformation International College. This audio lecture is protected under international copyright law and is not to be copied, distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. You may contact Reformation Christian Ministries through our website at www.reformation.edu. Reformation is spelled REFORMATION. By email, you can also contact us at president@reformation.edu. By phone in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8030. By fax in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8010. Or by writing to Reformation Christian Ministries, 13950 122 Street, Fellsmere, Florida, 32948 in the USA.